You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. The Me Too movement began, really, after candidate Donald Trump's Access Hollywood tape, but of course it really blossomed in 2017 with the exposing of Harvey Weinstein and his dismissal from his company after repeated accusations from notable actresses of sexual harassment. But Hollywood had operated in this way for decades. Leonard Maltin recently wrote in The Hollywood Reporter that Daryl F. Zanuck, the studio head of 20th Century Fox, would never have survived in the Me Too era. And dozens of other executives in the movies behaved similarly as a matter of course. The Hollywood casting couch was legendary. Howard Hughes, Hollywood producer and aviator, always did everything big. And a new book reveals that in addition to making a few gigantic movies and a huge wooden airplane, he excelled like no other Hollywood mogul in sexual harassment. That book is Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes Hollywood. And the author is my guest today, Corina Longworth. Corina Longworth is the author of other books, including Hollywood Frame by Frame, and she is the host and creator of a podcast called You Must Remember This. It's all about movies in the 20th century. Corina Longworth, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
In your book, you say something like, it's time to rethink the glamorization of the Playboy and stories that place women as collateral damage to a great man's story.
Yeah, I actually wrote that sentence, which kind of became the thesis of the book in some ways, the morning after Donald Trump's election. I just kind of woke up with those words in my head, and you know, it was fueled in some ways by just anger over this man who had these credible allegations against him. And it seemed like as much as we want to think that the world has changed, the world has not changed that much.
Right. I mean, when President Clinton was accused of all the things he was accused of, you know, that was sort of what presidents always did, right?
Well, I think until, you know, very, very, very recently, there was a sense that it was ungentlemanly to even discuss these things in public, that a man's private life was his private life, and women, you know, their experiences and in a lot of cases their trauma just didn't matter.
Now, you know a lot about Hollywood, and that's, you know, one of the things I love about your book, and it's a great book, and I think everybody will enjoy it, is the detail. I mean, you know a lot about Hollywood history. You said that in the earliest days of Hollywood or in pre-Hollywood motion picture history, there were quite a lot of women directors, writers, not just performers.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, really up until the late 1920s, there was quite a few more women in positions of power behind the scenes, acting as directors and producers and the creative forces behind the movies. And, you know, throughout the 1920s, there was sort of a process of commercialization and corporatization of the film business, which kind of helped to push a lot of those women out.
And why do you think it went like that? Why couldn't that have happened and women still been directors, cinematographers, and so on?
Well, I think it kind of coincided with a generational shift in the movie business as well. I mean, some of the filmmakers who had positions of power who were women, such as Lois Weber, were kind of on a natural career decline. And instead of them having the opportunity to mentor a new generation of women, the sort of newly corporate film industry was, you know, all the power was consolidated by men, and they did not invite women to the table.
You know, that's it's an interesting and similar argument to the discussion you have about the coming of sound pictures. You know, movies like The Artist and Singing in the Rain, as you point out in your book, kind of leave us with the impression that the great stars of the silent era's careers were ruined because they had terrible voices or whatever. But you have a different theory.
Well, I just don't think it's as simple as that, and it certainly was not as simple as that for every performer. You know, a lot of performers had fine voices and did make a transition, but for whatever reason, their time as stars was either just about up then or would be up in a few years. And the transition from silent film to sound film was more than just a technological transition. It was a cultural change as well, and again, a generational change. And pretty soon after 1927, which is when The Jazz Singer came out and which is when the studios started the wholesale transition to talking cinema, pretty soon after that, audiences began demanding different types of films. And in addition to just the fact of adding dialogue to films, much more about filmmaking changed. I mean, it did become an art form that required different types of performers.
What brought Howard Hughes to Hollywood?
Well, Howard Hughes was 18 years old when his father died. His mother had died a couple of years earlier. And Hughes was basically on the precipice of becoming the heir to a fortune in a very profitable company that his father had started creating oil drill bits. And Hughes could have waited until he was 21 to come into this inheritance, but he decided to fight through the court system and to fight the rest of his family so that he could take over the entire business at that time and have the entire financial resources of the business under his control. And his goal, like what he wanted to do with all of this money, was go to Los Angeles, and he wanted three things. He wanted to become the best golfer in the world, he wanted to become the best aviator in the world, and he wanted to become the most powerful motion picture producer.
And he didn't really succeed in any of those, but...
No. You know, he had measured successes. Certainly, he's famous for some of his contributions to aviation, and I think people who know more about aviation than I do can cite specific inventions and innovations that Hughes made that, like, allowed the jet age to be possible. And he was a very prolific defense contractor. In terms of golf, he gave that up pretty quickly. And in terms of Hollywood, he was active in Hollywood for 30 years or more, but the few films on which he took absolute total creative control don't really hold up as great films.
But you sort of start your story with Billy Dove. Is that the first actress that he was involved with?
That, as far as we know, she's the first actress who he had a serious relationship, yes. I mean, it seems that they met while he was still technically married to his first wife, a woman named Ella Rice, who he'd known all of his life and who he married in Houston before moving to Hollywood, kind of as a way of proving to his family and to the business that he had just taken control of that he was a serious adult. But then he didn't really seem to take that marriage seriously at all.
What happened to her?
After a couple of years, she got tired of Hughes ignoring her, and she went back to Houston. And they ultimately had a very costly to Hughes divorce, and then she ended up marrying a man who she was involved with before she married Hughes.
And now Billy Dove, she's not very well remembered today, but she was a huge star.
She was. At the peak of her career, which was around 1926, 1927, she was considered neck and neck for being the biggest actress in Hollywood next to Clara Bow. And Clara Bow had a persona as sort of a sexy young flapper, whereas Billy Dove's persona was a little bit more sophisticated and mature. But she was also revered as being one of the most beautiful women in the world and definitely in Hollywood.
Now, one of the things that you do in your book that's so great is to talk about the movies, specific movies. What are some films of Billy Dove's?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the films that were considered her greatest hits of the era are not available, as so many silent films are not available. But she kind of made a big splash as the romantic lead in The Black Pirate, starring Douglas Fairbanks. This was an early Technicolor film, and Billy was very beautiful, and she photographed extremely well in Technicolor. So that kind of made her a star. And then she made a series of films in the very early sound era, films that were partial sound films, where there was a little bit of dialogue, but they were generally shot like silent films had been. Films like Careers and Adoration, in which she, for the first time in her career and kind of as a new thing for actresses, these movies were about independent women having sort of adventures in the world, in the modern world of the 1920s. They weren't just there to be somebody's girlfriend or something like that. And then her career kind of wound down with two films that Howard Hughes produced as showcases for her.
Her relationship with Howard Hughes also wound down at the same time that her career wound down. I mean, in what part did he play in her, you know, demise?
Well, when he took over her contract, he kind of when they met, they had an affair for a while, and then they both left their spouses to be together. And then Hughes took over her contract, which had been the property of Warner Brothers. And he was not the most prolific producer. It took him a while to generate material for her. And during that time, Warner Brothers released some lower quality features that they had shot with her. And these features did a lot to diminish her star power. And then by the time Hughes' movies actually started coming out, there were two of them, one called The Age for Love, which has been lost. We can't see that now. And then another called The Cock of the Air. Both of these films were also pretty low quality, and they were not well reviewed, and they were not seen by a lot of people. And so by that point, it had been years since she had been in like a hit, high-quality film. And so her relationship, her romantic relationship with Hughes, fell apart as her career was falling apart, and she would make just one more movie before retiring.
So in this early period in Hughes's Hollywood career, was he as, I don't know what the word is, as weird as he later became?
Well, define weird.
Well, you know, in the later part of your book, you have him putting women under contract that he has no intention of making pictures with, putting them kind of, he doesn't even really have relationships with them. He just has them in case he needs them.
Right. I think he became kind of a collector of women. And, you know, some of that behavior is on display in the late 20s and early 30s. As soon as he releases Hell's Angels, which is his first movie that he directs, and which looked like it was going to be a folly because it took him 3 years to produce it, he ended up scrapping it after trying to shoot it as a silent film and then having to kind of redo it as a sound film. When that movie came out and wasn't a complete disaster, it made him a celebrity. It made him kind of the producer of the moment. And he used that newfound celebrity capital to start a production company, and he did sign people to contracts. But, I mean, for instance, I read in the book about an actress named Anne Vorschach, who he signed to contract to put her in the film Scarface, and then he put her in one more movie, and then he just kind of made, he made money off of her by loaning her out to other studios so that they could put her into movies. And he pretty quickly lost interest in actually helping her become a star himself, but he was happy to just, like, let the money roll in.
Well, of course, that was kind of Hollywood practice. I mean, the same thing happened to many performers, right?
Absolutely. But, you know, I make the point in the book that Hughes did things that a lot of moguls did, but he would just do it on kind of a grander scale, and he was more crude about it. And so that's certainly the case with Anne Vorschach. He didn't even make any pretense as to wanting to develop her as a star himself.
Well, you know, although you could make certain arguments about all the Hollywood moguls and Louis B. Mayer and Harry Cohn and Daryl Zanuck and all those guys, but those guys also had an artistic vision of motion pictures. Did Howard Hughes have that?
Well, that's debatable. I think that a lot of people felt that Hell's Angels, when it came out, had the most groundbreaking aviation scenes that had ever been put on film. His other film that he's credited with directing, The Outlaw, which came later, it has some beautiful cinematography by Greg Toland, who was a master. But I would, as far as giving Howard Hughes credit for having an overall artistic vision, I think that's a stretch. I think the aesthetic thing that unites most of the movies in which he had a hand is his obsession with the female body.
And you think that's more on display in his films than in other films of the era?
Absolutely.
Because that's, of course, that's, you know, and you say at some point in your book, and I can't say it as eloquently as you did, but that the commodity of the woman's body was, you know, what Hollywood was built on in a certain sense.
Sure. I mean, movies have always been, from the beginning, to some extent, about providing people with the pleasure of looking at beautiful people, particularly beautiful women. But again, Howard Hughes, in the way that he approached that, he was so much more vulgar than everyone else. I mean, even in Hell's Angels in 1930, he thought that the way to get people to watch his groundbreaking aviation film was by promoting it as being about Jean Harlow's body. So the posters for that movie featured a huge image of her falling out of a dress, while tiny little images of airplanes were sprinkled around the image of her body.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Karina Longworth. She's the author of Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood. One of the actresses that Howard Hughes encountered and that you discuss so well in your book, Seduction, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes' Hollywood, Corrina Longworth, is Jean Harlow. Harlow had a kind of a sad life, although she had a fabulous career with many great films. And one of the films that you talk about in your book is a movie I'd forgotten about called Bombshell.
Sure, yeah. I think it doesn't get credit for being one of the first screwball comedies, but it really helped to invent that type of comedy.
So did Hughes actually discover Jean Harlow?
Sort of. He gave her her first major film role in Hell's Angels, but he didn't actually, you know, pick her photo off of a stack the way that he did with Jane Russell. She was brought to his attention by one of the other actors in Hell's Angels, James Hall, who had been a boyfriend of hers, and Hughes had been looking for months for an actress who could star in the talkie version of Hell's Angels, because when they originally started shooting it, and it was a silent film, there was an actress with a, they had cast an actress with a very thick accent who couldn't perform in the talking version. So they were looking for months, and finally Hall ran into Jean Harlow and said, you know, why don't you come in to the studio where I'm working? This guy I'm working for has been searching for an actress. You know, maybe he'll give you a screen test. And so they did give her a screen test, and nobody saw any magic in the screen test except for Howard Hughes, and he decided on the spot that he had found his girl.
So he had to shoot the picture essentially twice because he shot it as a silent film, and then he had to use completely new actors. Are there other people who are in both, or no
yeah.
one's?
Yeah, no. The only actress he had to replace was Greta Neeson, who was the original lead, because her accent was so thick that she couldn't be in the talking version. But Ben Lyon and James Hall were the other two leads of the film, and they shot the silent version, and then they shot the talkie version, and the silent version was scrapped. But they and a lot of the crew members worked on Hell's Angels for 3 years.
And all of the aviation sequences, they only had to do those once.
Well, they technically only had to do them once, but Hughes was a perfectionist. And so a lot of the time of those 3 years was over shooting these aviation scenes and making sure that he was satisfied with the stunts.
Was this because Hughes was enjoying himself and had enough money to do whatever he wanted, or what did he... You know, why did he do it that way?
Well, certainly that was part of it. But, I mean, I think that he was really determined that this movie would showcase himself as a great aviator and as a somebody with great instincts for cinema. And so he was really determined to create these elaborate stunts and show airplanes doing things on screen that they had never done before. And so he just kind of kept pushing himself and pushing his stuntmen and his crews of flyers and pushing these airplanes, most of which were relics from World War I, pushing them to places that they had never gone before.
Well, was Jean Harlow involved with Howard Hughes?
Not as far as I can tell. I think that that is a rumor that has persisted, but in everything that I've read about her that seems credible, I don't think she liked him at all. I mean, I think that she, her initial experience with him of working on Hell's Angels was that he was very blatant exploitative of her body, which is something that made her extremely uncomfortable. And honestly, like, I think that he was busy with other women at the time as well.
Well, you know, I think it's common that actors are nothing like the roles that they play. And for somebody like Jean Harlow, who played roles that emphasized her sexuality, it was interesting because she really wasn't that kind of person at all.
No, she didn't feel comfortable with her body. She didn't feel comfortable broadcasting this sexuality, but after she did it so convincingly and seductively in Hell's Angels, she became typecast in these roles, and it was painful for her. She didn't like that, but, you know, she was blessed or cursed with this body that was considered extremely sexual for its time.
I love that scene in Bombshell where she makes fun of her own performance in Red Dust
in the barrel, bathing in the barrel.
Right.
Yeah, I love Bombshell, but I also love Red Dust.
Red Dust is great.
Yeah.
I like both versions of Red Dust. And the other version has, it was called Mogambo, and that has Ava Gardner, one of Howard Hughes' other fixations.
Yes.
Why wasn't he fixated with Grace Kelly?
I can't answer that. I mean, by the time Grace Kelly came onto the scene, Hughes' predilection for women had really shifted to brunettes.
Yeah, and Grace Kelly has smaller breasts.
Well,
Now, you said in the book, speaking of breasts, that when he marketed the Outlaw, that he actually had skywriters paint breasts in the air. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. That was reported by Variety and other publications that witnessed it.
That's nuts.
Well, it caused a problem because the production code administration, the censors of films, they were used to reviewing all advertising materials and applying their censorship rules to those as well as films. But nobody had ever used skywriting to promote a movie before, and certainly nobody had ever used skywriters to draw breasts in the air. And so this really flummoxed the censorship board, and I think that's why they were harsher on Hughes about some of his advertising materials than they would have been otherwise, because they were looking for a way to sort of punish him for doing things that were so outside the box.
The Outlaw, the film with Jane Russell, who later went on to a great career and is a fine actress. But that movie is a weird movie. It's weird not just – it's weird even in, before Jane Russell comes into the picture, the whole scenes with Walter Houston and Thomas Mitchell. It's a kind of an oddball picture.
Definitely. It's almost a psychedelic Western, and then it has this element, which now we can see as being campy, but it does seem like there's this latent homosexuality between the male characters. And then when they start sort of fighting over Jane Russell, it is only increased.
And, of course, there's that classic kind of Hollywood thing that you see in movie after movie where a man forces himself on a woman and she's pounding on him, and then of course she relents because she really wants it. That's like it's blatant in The Outlaw, but it's in so many movies.
Well, I think The Outlaw is a little bit different because this scene that takes place with Jane Russell and the actor Jack Butel, she very clearly says no, and you don't see her relenting. You see him threatening her to stop moving or he's going to rip her dress to shreds. And then the camera goes away, and then the next time you see her, she's fallen in love with him after this rape. So I don't think it's quite as like it's simple, or it's not the same thing as a film like, say, in The Quiet Man, when you have John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara struggling and then kissing. You don't see her capitulate until there's a time gap, and it's suddenly she's in love with him. So I think it's more troubling.
It's a troubling part of Hollywood. There are lots of things when you watch old films and you talk about old films in your podcast. You have to put things in their historical perspective, of course, but there are so many things because we're fortunately more enlightened, but although there's still terrible things that we see in movies today. But how do you enjoy a film when you see things that are repugnant?
Well, I think that you're right that you do have to put it in the context of the time and look at it as history. I don't enjoy watching a scene in which Jane Russell performs being raped, but I can understand why it's fascinating and troubling and how it sort of reveals something about the people who made the movie, including Howard Hughes.
One of the movies that I had never heard of, but since you told me about it, I watched it, was A Return of October. It was kind of a very sweet movie with Terry Moore. Tell us a little bit about Terry Moore.
Terry Moore was a child actress. She played a young Ingrid Bergman in Gaslight. She was in, I believe, Son of Lassie. She made what she called a lot of animal movies. And when she was, I believe, 18 years old, she met Howard Hughes, who had just taken over RKO Studios, which was about to release a film called Mighty Joe Young, which Terry Moore was in. It's sort of a kind of a remake of King Kong made by some of the same people who made the 1930s King Kong. And so she becomes involved with Howard Hughes, and about a year into their relationship, they go out on his yacht, and they have a marriage ceremony. And Terry Moore believed that this was a legitimate marriage, although without seeking a divorce from Howard Hughes, she went on to marry several other men. And then after Howard Hughes died, she came forward for the first time and publicly said that this marriage ceremony had happened and that she believed that she was Howard Hughes' legitimate widow.
Did you get a chance to talk with her?
I didn't. She is the only actress in the book who plays a major role in the book who is still alive. But I decided that because the book is basically about 10 actresses and 9 of them are not alive, to only talk to Terry Moore sort of wouldn't be fair to the others. And I also, I read the 2 books that she wrote about Howard Hughes, and I read hundreds of pages of depositions that she gave in the late 70s and early 80s, speaking about Howard Hughes and speaking about her relationship with him and her career in the context of these legal battles over Howard Hughes' estate.
Does it ever make you wonder, like, why, in case of Jean Peters or Terry Moore, why any woman would marry Howard Hughes?
Well, I think that if you look at some of the stuff that was being written about Hughes and being written about men and women in general in the culture in the 40s and 50s, there was this idea that men with money and power were what a woman was supposed to want in their lives, and that their goal should be to marry a man like that. And especially Howard Hughes was held up that way in the media as being the most eligible bachelor in the world. And so I think that there was that for sure, was that this is what these women were kind of indoctrinated into wanting. And I do think that he could be very charming in person. I think he was a master at seduction, and that it was easy to like allow yourself to believe that he really loved you, and that when he told you, you know, I'm not seeing other women, I'm just busy, I just have business conferences, I'm just working on airplanes, that he was telling you the truth, even as evidence came to mount that he was not telling the truth.
So he collected women, as you were saying, but he didn't particularly like women.
Well, his behavior on the whole suggests that he did not particularly like women, but I mean, I think that it was less about his collection of women was less about that than it was about this sort of compulsive need that he had from a very young age to be the greatest and to do things. If he couldn't do things the best, he would do things the most.
So the most girlfriends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, he really wanted to be, you know, quote unquote, better than other men and to compete against other men. And so if he signed actresses to personal performance contracts and or gave them engagement rings, he was taking them off the market so other men, other studio moguls, couldn't have them.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we return now to our conversation with Corina Longworth. She's the author of Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes Hollywood. One of the things about your book that I love is all the details about the history of Hollywood, in addition to this, you know, main thesis that you're talking about. And the studio system ended largely as a result of 3 factors: the coming of television, which drastically cut the audience for motion pictures, and the blacklist, which exiled many of the industry's greatest talents for alleged communist activity, and the Supreme Court decision that forced the studios to end their monopoly over production, distribution, and exhibition of films and caused them to sell off their theaters. And Howard Hughes played a role in the blacklist and a major role in the monopoly busting. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So both of those things happened within the context of him owning and managing RKO Studios, which had been one of the great studios since the 1930s. And it was kind of slowing down by the time he took over in 1947. But he really hastened the decline of RKO by being basically just terrible at managing a movie studio. I mean, up to this point of the 20 years he had been in the movie business, he was used to making a movie only every few years. And of course, a movie studio needs to make many movies every year in order to make its margins, in order to keep the business going. So he was bad at that. And then he gets involved in the blacklisting of supposed and alleged communists in Hollywood. And he was a fervent anti-communist, if for no other reason that he was a fervent capitalist. But he ended up closing down RKO Studios under the excuse that he needed to do so in order to make sure that there were absolutely no communists working there. But a lot of people, including a screenwriter who he fired named Paul Jericho, believed that Hughes was actually shutting down RKO because he couldn't figure out how to manage it and he needed time to reorganize the business. And then another thing was that right after he took over RKO, all of the studios had been fighting the consent decree established by the Supreme Court, which was going to mandate that they all divorced their production business from their exhibition business, because at that time all of the studios owned both the studio lots and they owned the movie theaters. And so this was determined to be a monopoly, and the Supreme Court said that you have to pick one or the other, and you have to start divorcing these businesses. But the studios were fighting it for years, and they thought that they would be able to use their lawyers to negotiate something so that they would at least be able to keep one finger in each pot, so to speak. Hughes decided that it would actually be better business for him as the owner of RKO if none of the studios owned movie theaters, because RKO owned fewer movie theaters than any other studio. So if nobody owned any theaters, he believed that he could negotiate with every theater separately and then get RKO movies into more movie theaters. So he, at his decision, RKO became the first studio to accept the government's consent decree as is without negotiating anything. And because he did that, all of the other studios lost their position to negotiate, and they had to fall in line as well.
So they must have hated him.
Oh, yeah. Well, they already hated him. They already hated him because for 20 years he had been violating all of the established norms of the film industry. And somehow it was never reported on that he was breaking the rules and kind of failing upwards. It was only reported that he was this maverick and this rebel and this sexy guy. So they already hated him. But then when he accepted the consent decree, it absolutely made him a pariah.
I've read other books about Hughes, but I never heard anybody say imply that, as you do, that after his plane crash, that he was brain damaged or that his behavior was altered because of it.
Well, certainly he had a history of head injuries. And the 1946 crash in which he crashed an experimental plane that he had designed into a Beverly Hills neighborhood, that was the worst and it was the final crash. But he got into an enormous number of plane crashes and car crashes over the 20 years preceding that. And so I'm not a doctor, but I think now we can understand better than perhaps people who have written about Hughes in the past that an accumulation of head injuries can change the way somebody's brain works.
Can you say that there's some behavior that happened after that didn't happen before the crash?
Certainly he had always portrayed obsessive-compulsive behavior to some extent, but things become escalated for sure after 1946. And this is when he becomes extremely overextended with all of his businesses. He is really accumulating more girlfriends than ever. This is when he starts kind of a factory line operation of sending scouts and spies out into the world to find women for him, to photograph them obsessively, to decide whether or not to sign them to studio contracts, and then if so, to sequester them in houses and hotel rooms so that they're available if and when Hughes decides he wants them. Things definitely escalate after 1946.
Well, this book, Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes Hollywood, it's really brilliant, and it's a great film history. I mean, it takes you through really the whole history of the Hollywood studio system. Karina Longworth, how did you get interested in movies? What tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I grew up, fascinated by old Hollywood. I grew up in Los Angeles in the 80s. So a lot of these stars were still around and still kind of making news. And I remember my mom introducing me to movies like The Wizard of Oz and Singing in the Rain and stars like Natalie Wood and Rock Hudson, who she loved. It just became something that I pursued on my own as I was a teenager, seeing more and more movies, going to revival houses in Los Angeles. And then I went to art school as an undergraduate and just kind of found myself working my way back to studying old cinema. And so I went to graduate school and I got a degree in cinema studies. And, you know, the rest is kind of, I worked as a contemporary film critic for a while, but I just always found myself being pulled back to studying old cinema.
When you look at contemporary films, let's take The Star is Born. You've probably seen all versions of The Star is Born.
Yep.
which is the best one?
My favorite film of all time is the 1954 version starring Judy Garland and directed by George Cukor.
Did you catch the references to that version in the current version?
You could call them references, sure. In some cases, they are exact lines.
Well, she sings, Lady Gaga sings a little snippet of the verse to Over the Rainbow in the beginning of the film.
Yep. And the font of the title is the same.
Anyway, this book, it's fascinating. I think everybody will love it. It's called Seduction, Sex, Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes Hollywood. And the author, my guest, the brilliant Karina Longworth, thanks so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Sure, thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.